welcome to the show. I think everything's working. If it's not, you just go ahead and let me know. All right. So I'd like to lead with something that one of you guys actually said in the chat, because you've been kind of energetic tonight already, which is great. He said, and I'm going to quote here, "I'm surprised they," meaning YouTube, "even ban right-wing channels. They're not even controversial, basically liberal." And I think that's actually a really important point. It's that when you think of the modern right, or at least modern conservatism, it's not. It's literally not, and I do think that I hold exception to this personally, that I'm not one of them. However, I can concede that when you look at modern conservatives, they all, in fact, many of them will come right out and tell you that they're classical liberals, right? So you've got this constant sliding toward the left with modern conservatism, and that's something that I find to be a real problem. It's like, there is no right, there's simply the left from 10 years ago. And I guess that's probably most noticeable when you think about things like gay marriage, and how basically as soon as the conservative right, if you want to call them that, sort of lost the argument, or at least I should say lost the legal battle at that particular time, they all just kind of conceded the point and gave in, as if, you know, losing that one battle at the Supreme Court was indicative of their value system, which surely it wasn't, unless it's all just a big game to them and the whole point is the fight, which surely it's not, right? But that's exactly how it is now. It's like modern conservatism, you know, from, and when I'm talking about modern conservatives, I'm talking about Ben Shapiro, Stephen Crowder, this kind of crowd, often don't even talk about like anti-white political issues, you know, issues in which white people are actively discriminated against, for example, which ought to be one of the biggest issues of our time. I don't talk about it because it's something that I just enjoy talking about. I talk about it because it's happening all the time, and because you're raising, you being society, not you as an individual, but because we're raising a generation of people who are being taught that on account of them being white, they ought to harbor some sort of guilt for the fact that their ancestors, frankly, built the Western or Western world or Christendom, however you want to put it, that they ought to feel some sort of guilt and self-loathing for that, and that they ought to be sort of self-punitive in one way or another. And that's evil. It's not just wrong. It's absolutely evil to raise a generation of young people who would see themselves as sort of arbiters of something negative on the basis of race. And it seems almost worse because it's a lie, right? Because white people aren't responsible for every evil ever. You can look at every civilization throughout the world and see plenty of barbarism. It could even be argued that you see more barbarism in other cultures, especially if you look at the modern world. You know, if you look at, for example, the Congo, you're going to see a heck of a lot more savagery than you do in the modern West, right? If you look back in time, you have to kind of like, you know, see things in their own context. But the idea that people on the basis of being white ought to have some kind of self-loathing, young people ought to sort of sacrifice on the basis of somebody else's decisions that were made, you know, a century before them, it's incredibly wrong. So yeah, okay, well, I think we kind of got that out of the way, but I just kind of, I saw that and I could really feel a sense of relatedness to that, because certainly when you look at the modern right, they're not right in any traditional sense. They're not really right-wing. They certainly are liberal. They concede every ground. And now they are, to be fair, probably the left from about 20 years ago. That's the modern right. And yes, to Meme Short, we can read your comments despite you getting censored by YouTube. I know it happens a lot of times now. It used to be that YouTube only ever censored the people who are creating the videos. Now it happens that they're censoring people who leave live chats and leave comments, and it's just kind of ridiculous. I mean, I never thought actually that they would see such of a big deal. And there are lots of people who I see in the chats now who are like, well, can you see me? I also am streaming over at DLive, by the way, if you do want to leave live chats live and be able to, you know, say more. Okay, and I did see you guys also talking about some of the kind of pop culture issues that are going on. And since we're just getting started and I just kind of like to keep things in a sort of a lighthearted mood to begin this show, we'll go ahead and go there. But I do want to say, I had no idea who Nicki Minaj was prior to the last few days. I didn't. I don't keep up with celebrity figures. I certainly don't keep up with rappers. I don't generally keep up with the drama surrounding such public figures. because I just don't care. That's not what I consider to be real culture. If I might be a little bit blunt there, I just don't. I consider it kind of like, you know, vacuous culture. So in any case, this rapper, who is female, Nicki Minaj, tweeted out some concerns about the vaccine, safety concerns, in addition to how the elites are using them as a sort of power grab, a way to control people. And then later went on Tucker Carlson, echoing some of those same things. And then the left turned against her. And that's what the left does. They eat their own. This isn't somebody who's traditionally conservative, even by modern conservative standards that we just discussed, and how bad they are. This is, you know, someone who's like, well, I'm publicly bi and proud bi, but now I'm straight and kind of all over the place in a very modern celebrity sort of a way, like give me attention sort of a way. But the left doesn't care. They only care about your sort of compliance constantly. And that's why I think that perhaps it's a little bit even more terrifying to be a public leftist. Because if you were that, right, there's no way that you could make public statements today and be confident or comfortable that you'd be the same way, or that those particular opinions would be accepted in just a few years. Because they're sliding so quickly now. You're like, yes, I just talked about how conservatism is somewhat the same way, but it's a lot slower. If you look at like the modern left and how quickly they just kind of dropped feminism as one of their embraces and instead switched to the whole trans thing, and are like, well, you know, women can't refuse to allow men inside of their bathrooms, you know, because that would be bigotry. You know, that kind of sliding scale, then you look back at, you know, some of these leftists and their pro-feminism comments from, you know, 5 years ago, and nowadays they'd be written off as downright transphobia. That's what it would be like to be on the modern left, and they really do destroy themselves in a way that I can't help but find somewhat amusing, and maybe I shouldn't, but it does kind of entertain me in that way. But I do think that the part that in Nicki Minaj's tweet that was most annoying to the sort of greater leftist narrative was the fact that she ended it, her complaint, with pray on it and make the decision yourself like a free human being. And see, the thing is, she is playing this celebrity role, right? This sort of cultural role. And I kind of cringe to say culture when you're talking about a public rapper playing this personality. But in any case, we'll call it culture because I don't have a better word for it right now other than vacuous. But it's kind of the job of these celebrity figures to do the very opposite of that. To tell people, frankly, not to pray, and to prevent them from making their own independent decisions. That's the purpose. It's why these people are propped up by the powers that be. They're supposed to say things like, you know, defer your own particular opinions, you know, not to yourself, not to God, but to me, you're better. And that's what's expected of these celebrity figures. And so I think that is something that's positive about someone like this doing that. You see it every once in a while. You saw it with, you know, Kanye West, who I also don't listen to. But regardless, it's the same kind of message. It's the, I shouldn't say you do you. I cringe at that too. But seriously, it is that don't look up to the celebrity class for your moral judgments kind of thing that was a bit refreshing, I'll say. All right, let me get a drink and then we will continue. Okay. All right. And also, since we're kind of on the celebrity run, whatever, let's go with it. You know the actor Jeff Daniels? You probably, if you don't recognize him by name, you'll recognize him by face. So this is the guy that we're talking about. He went on Stephen Colbert's show and decided he was going to go and complain about white people. Which is, of course, as we just described, the modern new thing, and so conservative ink will be quiet. But in any case, he went there to complain about how white people are an impediment to creating a new America. Okay, that's enough of his face. And you know, there's something about that, because it's like, firstly, can you imagine for a second, if you had, you know, some celebrity go on the Colbert show, whatever he's calling it now, and complain that, you know what, black people are really an impediment to the new world that we want to create, to the new world order or the great reset or whatever phrase. Like, can you imagine that? Well, black people just need to get out of the way and adjust their thinking because they're kind of an impediment to what we want to do here. Imagine the level of outrage and just like people just saying, you know, the ultimate kind of white supremacist thing. But he did this, you know, because it's all right in this direction. And he said, quote, "We have an opportunity in this country right now to welcome in a new America," unquote. And then he went on to talk about how Americans, or white Americans, sorry, suffer from a blindness and that they're not properly educated. So we need to be educated by reading certain books by leftist authors. And he cited To Kill a Mockingbird, but there were other just kind of black authors just littered in there. About how we need to be, I think the correct word, he didn't use it, but it would have been re-educated. That's what he went on TV to talk about, which is, disturbing in its modernity and the fact that it's becoming really common and acceptable to talk in these terms. And he went on, he said that, you know, well, To Kill a Mockingbird was really about how there's good in everybody. Then he goes on, "Is there goodness in everyone in 2021? And then he goes, "Not sure. You have to decide now if you're for or at least prepared to marginalize systemic racism." Okay. So then you have to step back and go, okay, but what systemic racism? Because, you know, he goes with this kind of, I don't know, accepted narrative, right? That there is systemic racism and that we have to do something about it and that you as an individual have to speak out about it. But you really have to go back to the root. The idea that there's systemic racism and that it's anti some group other than whites, right? Presumably it's anti-black. But from what I can see, as far as what the data shows, as far as, you know, what I hear from people in America's workplaces and in America's colleges, I get the impression that, in fact, there is systemic racism in America, but it's anti-white and not anti-others. In fact, we don't have to just kind of extrapolate based upon personal experiences, which we can, but you can actually hear these things directly from the colleges. I mean, we literally know that there's discrimination against white people in that way, such that white people have to get higher scores and so on. And yes, it's justified in the area of, well, you know, black people came from a harsher background or something. That's how they justify it. But then they don't use, you know, numbers related to poverty in order to separate people. They still use race. And similarly, it's in the America's workforce, where increasingly it's being spelled out that they're seeking people from, you know, what was the term? BIPOC now, I think. That's their current term to describe people who are anything other than white, right? It's literally used to cover anybody who's not white, whether they're indigenous or people of color is, you know, their whole idea. So that's the actual systemic racism that's appearing, or that you could say is here and has been here for some time. So you've got these people on TV who just go out there and say, well, you know, all these different white people need to accept the fact that they need to begin the fight against systemic racism, but then they never even go back to say, okay, but where is that? Because surely you ought to be able to identify where these, you know, systemic racism exists if it does. And then they're not even doing that at this point. Like, yes, there is actively discrimination against people who are white and people who are Christian, without a doubt, in America's workforce and in America's educational facilities, that happens. But they expect the bulk of America to watch that and go, well, yes, of course there is. Because, you know, when black people, you know, try and apply for jobs, they're just turned down on the basis that they're black from one institution to another. It's like, well, what reality is that? And then he goes on to say, quote, "I think the bloody Sunday for people of color was George Floyd's murder. And white people said, I had no idea we were taught one side of American history. I better look into that," unquote. This is a real guy, presumably. This is a real person who thinks this stuff. It's like, does he think that, I mean, let's even just go ahead and say, okay, George Floyd's death was an act of police brutality. Let's just accept that as his basis of conversation, because otherwise we're going to kind of get lost in this conversation. But even if you accept that, is that the only instance of police brutality ever that has resulted in a death? Of course not. It's just that, you know, the deaths of these other people who were not black didn't result in riots and firings and people being charged. Like, deaths of Tony Temper and so on. These deaths are just kind of ignored, like their lives don't matter. And so, surely, if there is systemic racism, it might be systemic racism against the people whom, when they are murdered, are ignored. Not those who, when they are killed, that there are riots, you know, and that there is every major corporation that comes out to stand beside that person who was killed. I mean, surely. I don't think this is particularly exaggerated here. I think it's pretty clear to see. And yet, you see these people going on the, you know, going on TV talking in these really, really presumptuous ways. And it's like, it's so manipulative because they start with this incorrect assumption and just go back from there. Do you take questions? I do take questions, yes. Trevor Smith says he's just repeating what he thinks is hip. Well, that's true, he is, but it seems like more than that. I think it's actively manipulative, because, I mean, he's not just some guy. He's also a guy who has this sort of celebrity status that's been given to him so that he can make these public announcements. That's why it was so weird when Nicki Minaj, you know, made an announcement which said, well, you should pray on this decision and do what makes sense for you. Because what you're used to is the celebrity class that's a lot more like Jeff Daniels, that just kind of toes the status quo, says what he has to say in order for the public culture to be manipulated. And that's what's happening. These, you know, celebrity figures are placed there in large part because they're willing to comply, because they're willing to say the things that they're supposed to say regardless of what they believe. And at a certain point, they really have, in an almost literal sense, sold their souls for the money and for the power, but they end up just sitting there regurgitating these ridiculous statements. And at least some people accept it. At least some people don't think, well, okay, what's systemic racism? At least some people go, oh, yeah, okay, well obviously, let's fight against that, because that must be the civil rights battle of our time. You know, some people really do think that way, because I guess they just haven't had the exposure that they ought to have, and that's the point of shows like this. Yes, you're right, he's likely rewarded for it. Well, he's rewarded for it with his position. I mean, that's why he's there. I don't think it's the first time he's spoken as an outright leftist. I'm pretty sure he was one of those on those, you know, those commercials after Trump won in the 2016 election. And you had all those different celebrity figures who were talking about how they wanted the Electoral College electors to change their votes so that Hillary Clinton would get the nomination instead, regardless of what happened that night. I remember that, and I think he was one of the people who was there. And it was like almost every celebrity all at once, and they had several of these. They had the celebrities without makeup, the we're just humans too, and you should like and respect us, and we should find us relatable, even though we don't have the same opinions or value system as any of you, and we consider you to have like the flyover country, right? That's the phrase that people over there in the West Coast elites think of. You know, the middle of the country is the part where you just fly over because you don't want to land there, where those people have, you know, Christian values or anything like that. Is that sounds pretty terrifying. Yeah, I want to stand there with those normal people. All right, hold on, let me get a drink. LC says, the USA is the most racially mixed and tolerant country in the world, no matter what the media would have you believe. Otherwise, how would people from Africa and other countries risk their lives? Well, it is true, and you still have people coming here, despite how oppressive it is, which has always been something of shock. But yeah, and for some reason, we're not allowed to close our borders to protect the, you know, to protect them from us, which you would expect if we were super oppressive. If America was super oppressive, you would think that the left would be like, no, we have to close our borders to protect those black people from coming here because they're going to be much better off over in the Congo. But that doesn't really seem to happen. But speaking of savage, despotic places, California just had an election, as you know. I'm good at transitions, as you can tell here. No, seriously. And of course, Newsom won, which wasn't particularly hard to call. The end result was, I think, 60-40, meaning 60% of the people who voted in California wanted him to stay. And of course, that presumes that there is no voter fraud, which, you know, there are always some degree of voting manipulation and voting problems and voting oddities, all of which are ignored. And it's interesting because you would think that the people who complained about the 2016 election would want to fix any issues in the voting system that would lead to voter distrust, right? Remember the people who complained the Russians meddled and all of that stuff. And maybe even the Russians hacked, which was also one of their narratives at the time, after the 2016 election. Not talking 2020 here. But you think that that particular group would be like, okay, well, let's fix the voting system such that voter fraud is less likely to happen. And instead, no, they're not interested in that. And so you start hearing these reports out from California, or at least I did, of the people who got these mail-in ballots that they didn't request and then went to go and vote and they weren't on the voter rolls and then were given provisional ballots for no reason. Stuff like that, a lot of inconsistencies. Now that said, that doesn't mean that that actually changed the result. Like, this is California. So I'm under no delusions that, you know, California had become a utopia of conservatism overnight and suddenly would have voted for someone else that would be, you know, more like what you and I would choose, for example. And given the massive disparity between the voting, that actually makes it more likely that you don't have voter fraud impacting it as greatly. It's kind of funny, but it's like, it's a lot easier to engage in fraud if you have like a 51-49 percent on the ballot. You don't have to do as much manipulation in order to make that change. But in any case, again, this is California, and I don't want to seem dismissive. I know that there are millions of good people in California. There are millions of people in California who voted to recall. There are millions of people in California who voted for Trump. And it's easy to kind of, in 2016 that is, and it's easy to kind of forget because you look over at California, you look at how bad it is, and you're like, is there anybody left over there who's decent, who's voting? And why haven't you left? And I get it. Moving states is an extreme difficulty. And you can get locked in, especially because there aren't that many people who want to go into California, which makes it particularly difficult to lose your house. I know somebody in Portland who had that very issue, like, you know, living there and then wanting to get out. And it's like, well, the value of the homes was dropping because who would want to move in there into Portland and be surrounded by Antifa and so on. So he was kind of unable to get out of Portland because he was unable to sell the home for any value as to be able to leave to go somewhere else. And I think there are some people in California who have that same problem. It's like property values are officially pretty high in California, except for you have to find somebody who's willing to buy, somebody who's willing to move in. So yeah, I get it. There are a lot of problems there for those in California. Though after this election, you can expect, I hesitate to call them COVID restrictions to increase, but I guess you could say, I would expect politicians over there to feel more comfortable in imposing on the rights of Californians now after this vote. I would expect them to feel comfortable at this point in just kind of dismissing people's overall rights and freedoms because, you know, they've got voter approval as far as they're concerned, right? And in fact, that's already happened. I know I just read before the show got started that LA County now issued a new health order that will require proof of vaccination for all customers and employees in indoor bars, wineries, breweries, nightclubs, and for outdoor mega events, which is basically sports games. So there's the kind of vaccine passport that just went into effect, and that was announced the day after the election, which totally isn't coincidental at all. So we're told, right? It means nothing. They just do it right after the election. They wouldn't announce that beforehand because that might change something, you know? And instead, you know, he's playing the whole, I just care about you so much, you know, thing. That was Newsom's kind of shtick is, well, he just cares so much about the people, and that's his reason for everything. And also their freedoms, but, you know, it's difficult to weigh them. No, seriously, I do feel for the people out there in California who are having to live under that. And now, of course, they're doing the, like I said, the vaccine passport thing, prove your vaccination status. And it's really kind of become nefarious. Like, even when you look at these, like, volunteer organizations, like to, say, rebuild Louisiana after the hurricane, all of that, it's all, well, if you've got your vaccination status, you can come help. And at the same time, they use it like a your papers, please kind of situation, where they're like, not only now do you have to have this vaccine, which, okay, just accept that for what it is for a moment, but then you have to carry around your proof of vaccine card, right, and then present it as soon as you're asked for it. And it's like, isn't that a little, you could call it fascistic, I suppose, but isn't that a little odd? Like, seriously, have you ever been asked to do anything like that? To not just get a specific, we'll call it a medical procedure, to be generous, but to get this medical procedure against your will, right? But then be forced to carry around this little card to kind of prove it? And you present it as soon as you're asked to the tyrants who dictated it in the first place because you have no kind of value in and of yourself. It's like, oh, what is that? Like, I honestly can't think of a decent parallel to that. Like, yeah, in different despotic regimes throughout history and throughout the 20th century especially, there were times when people were asked to present their papers, that was identification papers, that were necessary for transportation. From one area to another. And that was, you know, highly controlling and used to try and enforce and create a tyrannical state. I get that. However, I can't think of an instance where people have been forced to use their medical vaccination cards or anything that parallels that and to present it, you know, as a sort of ID in and of itself. And what does it identify? Because really, when you think about it, okay, so I've got this card that identifies me, but doesn't, because it's not an actual form of ID, contrary to, you know, certain politicians and their belief systems, but it's just this proof of vaccination status. But what's interesting about it is that they're using it as a form of ID, which means, you have to think about it, they see it as indicative of identification, because they see it as indicative of your value system itself, and which group you belong to. And that's where it becomes really interesting for me, is that when you really think about it, the whole point of this whole show me your vaccine card thing is, like, so that they know which side you're on. It's not so that they know if they're safe or not, because in many ways that has nothing to do with it. Multiple overlapping ways. But no, it's actually about whether or not you're part of the club. It's almost like a membership card in an ideological system. Or you could even argue in sort of a religious-ish system, because there's certainly like a cult-like mentality to it, right? That's where we are. It is the modern ID because they want to make sure that not that you're vaccinated, not that you have a certain medical procedure done necessarily, but simply that you have the right ideological position, and that card is proof of it. It's proof of, in the very least, your willingness to comply with the ideological left out of fear. It's proof that you're willing to bend the knee. And I said this last time and I'll say it again, I realize that there are some people who are being forced into an impossible situation where they're being forced to choose between feeding their families and getting the shot, and it's evil and you should never be placed in that situation. I get that. I have an immense amount of compassion for your situation if you're one of those people. I get it. None of that, however, takes away from the fact that they are using this ID that isn't an ID as proof in order to separate two parts of society, the part that will comply and the part that won't, so that they can better alienate and isolate those who will not comply with their coming system, whether or not they're calling it the New World Order or the Great Reset or anything else. It doesn't really matter what they call it. It matters what it is. And ultimately, it's not an ID system per se. It's, do you comply? Yes or no? Let me get a drink. The Shuggy says, I'm vaxxed, but I refuse to show my damn card. Well, good for you. Good for you. Because, I mean, really, you are creating a... not you. But they are creating a two-tiered society so that they can basically most easily eliminate the people who refuse to comply. And I'm starting to see they're doing things to try and... like, I saw it recently, I think it was... yeah, it was in Maryland. Where Larry Hogan, who is the officially Republican governor there, is targeting areas that are not willing to vaccinate. Okay, now bear with me. I'm going to send out these different crews to go and knock on people's doors and see if they can get them vaccinated. Okay, so they're targeting these areas, which supposedly are poor areas or whatever, regardless of the fact that it's free, doesn't really matter. They're targeting these areas, and it's like, okay, but how do you know which areas have been vaccinated and which ones haven't? Like, doesn't it, like, alarm you a bit that they have that data? Because it does me, because that means that there's a database somewhere of who's been vaccinated and who isn't, so that what? I mean, what's the bottom line? What's the kind of end of the road to that? And again, this is Larry Hogan, who I think I've done like at least two videos on, because he's an incredible tyrant. I don't think it's hyperbole at all to call him a tyrant, as someone who locked people up, literally has them imprisoned for violating an executive order. I mean, there's a lot of tyranny to go around in that whole picture, because, you know, there's him for issuing the order and then trying to get it enforced. There's the officers who arrested the individuals, you know, who, for example, there's one guy who held a party in his backyard with consenting adults who came over to have this party outdoors. Like, you have the right to freely assemble. Doesn't matter why. You know, that right is distinct from the right to petition your government for a redress of grievances, correct? So the right to freely assemble, no less on your own property, is a protected constitutional right. Is a constitutionally protected right, you might say. That's probably more accurate. In any case, Larry Hogan had those people arrested by creating a decree that he thought was enforceable, you know, criminally. The police came over, arrested people, that went to an actual court where an actual judge decided to put someone in prison, or, you know, for like a year for violating an executive order. I mean, that's kings in America. That's what that is. You created a king because only a king can sign an executive order that basically creates a law on a whim without a legislative process that results in people being dragged away to prison if they violate that, regardless of whether or not, you know, they're exercising their God-given rights or not. Like, that's having a king. So yeah, and Larry Hogan, he just seems to get worse and worse, and I don't know, I can't believe that he's someone who's being identified as a Republican, or who identifies. I guess you could say that the line between Democrat and Republican is certainly rather blurry at this point. You would think that the rest of the Republicans would be like, no, he's not one of us. And I would be, you know, if it was my party, you know, if I was an actual representative of the Republicans, I'd be like, he's not one of us. You know, he's a Democrat who won't properly identify himself, so he gets elected because there's an R next to his name. It's actually alarming that you don't have other Republicans doing so, and I think it speaks to how much they care about their own value system as opposed to just playing a political game. Because at this point, you would think that people could look beyond it and say, okay, there's something greater here. This is not supposed to be a political game. This is people's lives that are being destroyed. It's their families that are being destroyed. It's their businesses that are being destroyed. It's time to stop playing a political saga and actually start fighting, but you don't see that happening. So in the latest incarnation of Larry Hogan's tyranny, you have him looking around at these different communities that are least compliant and then coming out with his little stormtroopers to knock on their doors and harass them about how they can comply. Yes, in their words, how they can get vaccinated, but really that translates to, as we just covered, how they can comply. And then what happens from there? What's the next stage? What's the next stage to punish the areas that don't comply? Are we going to change how they're funded? Why not? And I say why not because that's what I think that should happen, but I say why not because I don't see the moral argument from their standpoint that says, okay, we can do all this other stuff. We can, you know, control where people can go. We can control whether or not they have parties. We can control whether or not they have rights at all. We can control whether or not they can open their businesses. We can, you know, we can do all of that, but I draw the line at, you know, removing funding for this particular area that won't get vaccinated, or closing down places in this area that won't vaccinate to the correct degree, or what have you. Like, when you accept, when you look at their actions as indicative of their moral values, then it becomes really worrisome about where exactly they're going, because I don't see a kind of bottom line. I don't see a thing that they won't do. Do you really think that they would be unwilling to put people in detention camps because they didn't take the vaccine? I don't. I don't see that at all. In fact, I've seen so many people at this point that seem to want that, that seem to want any sort of punitive action taken against the unvaccinated. And I don't just mean that at the political level, I mean that at the individual level. You'll see people just on Twitter and stuff who are really advocating for this. Tistram Sydney says, so let me get this straight. The vaccine producers are not responsible. The doctors are not responsible. The government is not responsible. But if I refuse the vaccine, I'm responsible. Yes, that is exactly the way that the situation is, according to what we're told. Yes. Kind of like that meme where it's like, it shows someone getting vaccinated and the person getting vaccinated says, so will this make me immune? And the doctor says, no, but the company is. Yeah, immune from liability. And I guess before we go any further, I should bring up the upcoming rally that's happening this weekend in DC, which is supposed to be in support of the January 6th defendants, which is a good cause. I have spoken at length multiple times against those who have been tortured and denied their rights after the January 6th protest. I absolutely think they deserve better treatment. I absolutely think it's a good cause. However, I do not recommend that you go to Washington, D.C. For the rally. In fact, I can't see who really organized it. It's really fascinating because it seems to be a rally that is being promoted by the media. It is being promoted by, frankly, the feds, right? You see these different government agencies talking about how you have this event coming up where all the different right-wingers, all those evil people, are coming to DC again, as they put it, and there might be another insurrection. This is all of their terms, right? But I have yet to see a single group that's really behind it. Like, even if you look at the groups that supposedly want to, like the Proud Boys specifically banned their members from going because they're like, no, it's a trap. You know, we don't need anybody else who is engaged in that kind of thing. We don't need anybody else getting their lives thrown away. Why would we want that? You had many similar different groups. I think the 3%ers were the same way. I can't see anybody behind it. The only people I see behind it is the media, who seem to be really pushing this hard. That's it. I mean, ultimately, at this point, right, if you accept that the Biden administration is fiercely opposed to, I'm just going to say, people like us. I know who you guys are and what you believe. I see you in the live chats every Thursday, and you know who I am at this point. I think the Biden administration is fiercely opposed to people like us. I think they've made that clear. They've made that clear when they say that anybody who's, you know, distrustful of the government is an enemy, for example. They make that clear when they talk about the different topics that would make an extremist, as we've discussed before, which is anybody who questions them or anybody who's to the right of Karl Marx, and so on, right? When you accept that the Biden administration opposes people like us, then you have to ask, what would be the possible benefit in holding a rally up there in DC? Do we seek to shame them? Because that's what a political rally typically seeks to do. To shame people into action. Is there anybody who really thinks that's what's going to happen? Because I don't. I don't think these people can be shamed. In fact, I think that the people behind the Biden administration are quite pleased at what's happening in January 6th, and to the January 6th protesters, rather. And I find it really jarring that the very few of the official Republicans have been willing to speak out for these political prisoners. You've had people like Elizabeth Warren who spoke out before any Republicans did, because she was concerned that the use of solitary confinement amounted to torture. And it is being used to torture them into, you know, saying what they want them to say. But at this point, holding rallies in DC is dangerous and futile. It's futile because you can't shame these people. And it's dangerous because, frankly, it's enemy territory, politically speaking. You know, if you were to get arrested even on a, you know, trumped up charge for something you didn't do, let's just say you relied upon a jury trial as you'd want to in such a case. Well, okay, but this is a place that voted, I don't know about the recent election, but in 2016, they voted 97% for Hillary. Like, stronger than anywhere else in the country. 97% for Hillary Clinton in the year that Trump won the election. I mean, that gives you kind of a picture of what Washington, D.C. is like. Washington, D.C. is filled with the people who make up government. I mean, that's it. It's filled with bureaucrats. You don't want to have to deal with a court system there. That's one of the reasons the January 6th defendants are getting such a hard time. If they were, you know, in their home states, they'd have a much better chance both in the court system and they'd be treated better in the prison and jail systems, respectively. And then there's the fact that when it comes to D.C., you don't really have a ability to defend yourself. And that's something that Antifa took advantage of in times past, where before the January 6th event, there were like several different rallies that took place in D.C. I don't remember if I went to one or two before January 6th, but in any case, they took place. And then at the end of the evening, as people started going home and separating, Antifa groups would attack different Trump supporters and their families. You know, there were lots of videos that came out at the time. And the thing is, your ability to, you know, carry a gun, for example, basically doesn't exist in D.C. You have to go through this really long, ridiculous process in order to get it approved, and you have to live inside of Washington, D.C. There's no concealed carry reciprocity with other states. So you're basically just a sitting duck. There's really no reason why you'd want to go there. I mean, why you'd want to take your family there. I get it. It's a good cause to support the January 6th protesters. I don't think that's something that would be... I don't think they'd be helped at all. And I don't think there's a benefit in you ending up in the same jails that they're in. So yes, I do think it's likely to be a trap if there were a large degree of participation. Most likely there won't be much participation and therefore nothing will happen. They'd only be likely to have, you know, a big sort of false flag event if it was to be a big large-scale protest. And with the people that have been warning about it, I don't expect it to be particularly big, and that's a good thing. Frankly, like I said, the only people that I see pushing it is like the media. I haven't seen any people on the right who are pushing it and saying to go. In fact, even Trump said not to go. I'm not sure that was today or yesterday, but even Trump said not to go, if that means anything to you at all. So yeah, stay away from it. Michael MJL, welcome, says, marchers never get anything done shouting at buildings. Go to your legislature's offices and demand a hearing organized for effective change. Okay. I sort of agree. I think that those on the left have more of an impact as far as getting things changed because they're willing to show up in places where they're not wanted. And I do think that's actually a policy that we should do. Not even necessarily their offices, but what you saw happen in recent years is these protests happening around people's houses and so on. And I think that as the kind of political climate increases, you're going to see more of that. And ultimately, when you're thinking about things that matter enough, like, for example, political prisoners, And yeah, I think that putting pressure on wherever possible and making life uncomfortable for people in political office just by being where they are and where they don't want you is actually a good strategy. I do think that there is something kind of pointless about, for example, you know, a protest outside the White House or something like that. Because, like, you think Biden's going to look out the window and go, oh no, the Trump supporters are here, I'm going to have to call up the Department of Justice and make some changes? I don't think that's going to happen at all. I don't think anybody thinks that's going to happen. And I always thought it was a little odd that you kind of often had these protests around the White House as if that was going to accomplish a whole lot. And obviously it's not. So I do think that those on the right in conservatism need to be more, I shouldn't use the word aggressive, because that's, I don't mean to start attacking people, but do need to be kind of more vocal in areas in which they're not expected. I think that you kind of have this idea that those on the left will kind of fire up a storm. And yes, they go kind of crazy with the riots and stuff. And then this idea that modern conservatives or those on the right or whatever, we'll just kind of lay down and take it. And that's one of the reasons why we've lost so much ground, culturally speaking, because there's no expectation that those on the right will fight back. And we're starting to see some changes in the area of like things like school boards and individual parents kind of coming together with other parents in order to kind of create almost like a coup of sorts to put enough pressure on school boards and to create change. And that can happen also with city councils. It's just a lot easier to affect change in much smaller circumstances. That's why organizing locally is so important. Okay. Kanadon on DLive says, I used to want to see DC. I don't care to anymore. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't recommend going during one of these times when they have these protests planned. So, yeah. And I mean, when it comes to DC, it's actually a pretty fairly crime-ridden place, which is, you know, shocking, of course, for a place that has this basically a gun-free zone and which has very heavy Democrat concentrations. I know it's absolutely shocking. Okay. Moving down, though. Let's see. Okay, you're talking about how high the recovery rate is with COVID. Yep, no doubt. I guess we'll go ahead and talk about General Mark Milley for a bit, since that's been something that's been kind of leading the news, which is, of course, that during the active Trump administration, this general, Mark Milley, made secret calls to Chinese officials, which I always thought you called treason. It's not really a word that I've seen thrown around that much, which is kind of odd, because I thought that as we defined treason, it was surely in conspiring with a foreign government who is not just foreign, but also objectively our adversary, in order to tell them that he would warn them if we were to attack, which is apparently what happened. That he told China, which, as far as I'm concerned, our biggest enemy isn't Russia, it would have to be China, that he called China and told them that if Trump was going to attack, he would give them the heads up, that he would warn them ahead of time. And I don't see how that's anything other than absolute treason, considering that he's, you know, supposed to answer to the President of the United States, who at that time was Trump, right? So it's kind of jarring to see it called anything else, or to see the sort of mainstream left-wing media come to his defense. And Milley said that his actions were routine and part of his normal duties. And that just kind of causes my head to just start worrying, like, okay, to what degree, like, how normal are we talking? I'm not trying to make a joke of any of this, but exactly how often has he called China and our other enemies and told them that he'd give them a heads up if we were about to nuke them? Just asking, because I fail to see how that should be a normal part of his duties. I mean, I don't know where he thinks he gets his job description or where he thinks he gets his orders, but surely that isn't it, right? I mean, surely. And just to give you a kind of a reminder, this was the same guy who went before Congress and started talking about white rage, right? How that was something that bothered him, how members of the military ought to be educated in white rage and what that is and how they can basically atone for multi-generational sins committed by white people. This is kind of like some overlap here between what we talked about earlier. I mean, and you have seen, or at least I have seen, some Republicans talk about how he needs to get court-martialed in the very least, and he needs to get fired, and that's all expected. I am kind of shocked with the degree to which the left-wing media has just kind of covered it up. Like, honestly, I mean, there's a point at which you would just think that they would just say, okay, we can't let this one go. Like, this is just too big, it's too bad, it's just too incredible for us to cover up. But instead, when I've, you know, tuned in to, like, MSNBC and so on, they're acting like it wasn't that big of a deal. Or rather, that Trump's mental state necessitated that he acted in such a way. That Trump's mental state gave reason for it and excused it. And it's like, wait a minute. They're actually saying that because there's actually a process that they were constantly talking about back when Trump was in office that someone is supposed to do if he really thinks that Trump's mental status is questionable and the rest of, you know, the higher office would kind of get together with Pence and so on and they'd decide if he had his mental faculties. But instead, none of that. No, he just called China. Just called China. Like that was just the appropriate thing to do. Okay. It's just kind of surprising. Okay. Carl DeFranco says, maybe it's better if DC worries about white rage. Yeah, I hear you. Many saying no accountability for these treasonous acts unless revolution, which shows they do not want dark days or have to imprison traitors. Yeah, I'm not really sure exactly what you're trying to say there. Sorry. Okay, and he's a communist. Yes, it would seem that he is a communist who... what is it with just how many communists we have in these sort of high-level military positions and also in the area of our intelligence community? I mean, it's very... Well, McCarthy was right kind of thing, isn't it? It's like when you just step back and you go, wow, they're actually everywhere. It's almost like they're in academia and they're in Hollywood, the entertainment industry, and then they're in the political class, and you're like, okay, so maybe people should have just listened to him a bit. Mark asked me if can I get on Lauren Chen's show. I mean, if she invited me, I'd be happy to. Okay, in any case... let's move on. What do you think? Let's move on for now. Let's talk about the New York governor. And this is not Cuomo, of course, because Cuomo was removed from office after his multiple scandals. So instead, we have the new governor, who is wonderful because she's female. I have been reliably informed that she is the first New York female governor, and it is for that reason that we should all be applauding and be constantly pleased with the job that she's doing. So I kind of offer that as a sort of, well, it sets the tone for where we go from here. So her name is Kathy Hochul, and she has gone full tyrant, which I guess maybe it shouldn't be surprising for a New York politician, but in any case, she's great because she's female. Just remember that, just keep telling yourself. And she's actively involved in some degree of censorship against Christian organizations. Specifically, she wrote a letter to Mark Zuckerberg, right, the CEO of Facebook, requesting information on any and all existing efforts to combat misinformation regarding abortion laws, procedures, and their availability. She's going after LifeSite News, and pressed for Zuckerberg to then curb the spread of misinformation by people like LifeSite News, but on topics of not only abortion, but also COVID, vaccines, and voting rights, as she put it. Now, LifeSite, I'm unaware of any misinformation provided by about the topic of abortion. Like, in fact, I don't really see misinformation on the topic of abortion. I see information on both sides that are at times jarring and at times disturbing and at times graphic. I can agree with all of those terms, for sure. But actively misinformation, I mean, that kind of alleges that there's something untrue that was stated, and that's not the case. But instead, she's kind of going after what is, rather troublingly when you think about it, her political opponents, which is the sort of, I guess, Christian right, I guess you could say, through censorship. By leveraging the private sector, in this case Facebook, in order to shut down a private company, LifeSite News, that she wants silenced because she finds their political, religious, and cultural opinions to be different to her own, such that she wants them silenced. And at the same time, and one of her other, remember, she's a woman and therefore she's perfect, don't question anything about her, we've been reliably informed. At the same time, she's opposing religious exemptions to the recent vaccine. And she said, and I quote, "I'm not aware of a sanctioned religious exemption from any organized religion," unquote. I mean, so? I mean, that to me seems like a really odd statement for a politician in America to make. Mostly because when we're talking about religious exemptions to vaccines, we're not seeking the government's approval of one religion or another. Whether it's an organized religion or not doesn't determine whether or not it's a valid religious belief, for example. You don't need a church to tell you what you believe, right? You can sit there with your Bible and be a Christian, for example. It's really disturbing because what she's talking about is basically state-sanctioned religion. Like, very quickly, she's like, well, there's no state-approved religion, which is what she means when she's saying, well, she's not aware of a sanctioned religious exemption by an organized religion. She's basically picking and choosing between which religious groups she considers to be valid based upon their views on the vaccine. Like, it doesn't take a lot of work for a Christian to oppose this most recent set of vaccines, for example. You know, you could do it based upon the aborted fetal cell lines that they were tested and developed upon, based upon your belief in the sanctity of the human body, based on your belief that the body is a temple, that, you know, God created you in the image and likeness of him, and therefore that you don't need an injection in order to, you know, survive. You could even find it, you know, contrary to your religious beliefs and to that very design of yourself, that you would need a vaccine. That you'd be required to get one would be evil. You could say that it was the mark of the beast, perhaps, based upon the fact that in the current times we're living, the vaccine is being used in order to create a world in which you can't buy and sell without it. You could go with all of those or any of those. Doesn't really matter. The point is that a government, our government, the American government and the government of New York, shouldn't be in this in the place where they're determining which Christian denomination is valid and which one isn't, and whether or not your religious exemption is valid or not. I mean, to what degree do you have to prove it to this tyrant? You have to start sending in your Bible quotes and your interpretation. And then they're going to argue back that that's not what it actually means. That's not what that verse means according to us, the wise government. I mean that's where this is going. Ultimately, I mean, because that's what you're talking about. You're talking about the governor deciding which organized religions are acceptable. Highlander One says they hijacked the word vaccine. Well, yes, they redefined vaccine and vaccination because the previous definitions didn't count. Didn't encompass the new shots. That's certainly true. But there's been a lot of redefining in the last year or so. That's for sure. Because yeah, okay, we'll just kind of move on from that. All right, hold on. Kyle DeFranco says pro-life websites are illegal in France. Wow. I don't even know what to say to that. It's kind of... okay, I find it shocking, in any case. All right. I do want to say the BBC just reported, and I'm just moving on to England after France, but the BBC just reported that the UK government is chasing 300,000 travellers who may have broken quarantine rules throughout the last year, which is something. So yeah, they found that basically what they had was when people coming into the country, you know, from vacations and so on, they were requiring that people do the whole self-isolation, you know, quarantine thing. But it was done on basically a sort of trust system in which they weren't actively enforcing it. They were just relying on people to comply out of fear. And some of those people, it now turns out about 300,000 of them didn't comply. And so the government is going to try and round these people up months after their supposed crime, because they're calling it a crime, and imprison them in the prison system in which they keep having problems with the virus going around. That, yes, yeah, seriously, they're actually on that. That's the way they're going. They're going to start imprisoning people for refusing to sit in their hotel rooms for 10 days when they weren't actively sick. There are also, back in this country though, it would seem that there are some lawsuits sort of starting against the mandate from Biden. And at the very beginning, right after the announcement, there were, it was 25 different states that said that they were going to, that said that they were going to fight back. They were going to basically start a lawsuit against the Biden administration. Those are the states that said they were going to fight back, those in red. And we haven't actually seen that happen. So far, we have one state, that's Arizona, that has started a lawsuit against the Biden administration. Say, basically, this isn't an abuse of your power. You simply don't have this much power. You're trying to vanquish state rights. You're, at the same time, you know, violating the rights of the citizens. So Arizona's the first one, but you've got all of these different states, 25 of them, who said that they would sue. And I have to ask, where are they? Seriously, where are they? It's 25 and Arizona's the first one. Now, I may have an answer, and that comes from the fact that there's actually a private organization called the Job Creators Network, which is made up of all these different small businesses. And by small business, we don't mean less than 100 employees. You can get a small business and be significantly bigger than that. And so the Job Creators Network has also said that they're going to sue. But what they're waiting for is the official announcement from OSHA saying that this rule is going into effect. Because, interestingly, it hasn't actually happened yet. And so for that reason, the Job Creators Network is just kind of waiting for this OSHA rule. And I don't know, but it seems like an odd delay that the Biden administration, you know, came out and they gave their speech. I say their speech because it's like, we know that Biden didn't write it, but he did say it. So it seems like kind of like almost like a collective thing. Like somebody wrote it. We'll just call them them, you know, who knows who's behind the scenes at this point. He keeps talking about the people who are giving him directions about what he's supposed to do. And then he gets cut off in the middle of a sentence sometimes. So we know it's not him. And that's really the only thing that we know about who really is president of the United States at this point. It's not him, but it's somebody. In any case, the OSHA ruling hasn't actually gone into effect. And so for that reason, in the very least, this Job Creators Network isn't ready to sue, because you can't really sue on the basis of a speech. You can only sue on the basis of an actual rule change. So they're waiting for that. And it's possible, and it is kind of benefit of the doubt here, but it is possible that the other 24 governors are simply waiting for this OSHA rule to come into effect. But that does seem generous. It seems more likely that instead it's easier to talk than it is to actually do something. Because you would think they'd want to go ahead and get the injunction as soon as possible and let people know, most importantly, as soon as possible, that, hey, you don't have to lose your job. You know, we've got the injunction. Everything's okay for now. You can go about your life, and your family isn't going to starve. And that's important, because that's what we've really seen. I mean, that's the reality that a lot of people are living in. Is my family going to starve if I refuse to get this shot? And then they have to kind of choose, kind of weigh the likelihood of a bad reaction. And, you know, to YouTube, I'm not saying there's lots of bad reactions, just that they happen with every drug. 22,000 Americans die from NSAIDs every single year. So, I mean, and then you're talking about over-the-counter drugs, aspirin and ibuprofen. I wrote an article on this topic, actually, recently. But in any case, that's the situation. And it's, gosh, it's so evil. Anyway, John Cox, welcome to the show tonight. He says, I find it very telling that Congress has been exempted from the Biden mandate. Yeah, isn't it? Kind of like how when they passed Obamacare, they were all exempt from that too. It's like they pass these things and they know, they're willfully aware. You know, it'd be one thing, right? If you had kind of the view, let's just take Obamacare because it's easier to talk about it in the context of the platforms that I'm on. Let's just take Obamacare. It'd be one thing if they all just thought, you know, it's the compassionate thing to do to have free healthcare. Damn the consequences. We don't think there are any because, you know, we're oblivious or something. To every other country around the world and all of their problems. We're oblivious. We just think this is a good thing. It's the right thing to do. And therefore, we sign it in. Okay. But the very fact that they said, okay, but not for us, means they didn't think it was an objective good thing. It means they didn't want to live under it, and yet they were willing to enforce it on other people. And that's the thing. It's like when they're willing to go ahead and do that, when they're willing to say, well, you know, not for us, then they're actively acknowledging that they know that what they're doing is wrong and it's something that they wouldn't want to live under, but they see themselves as better in so many ways, right? Because they're elitists. They literally see themselves as being the elites in the country who know better about what you need, which is entirely different from what they need, because they wouldn't want to actually live under Obamacare any more than they'd want to live under this most recent vaccine mandate. So they've got the exemption. I do find one thing particularly interesting, which I haven't been able to really figure out the reasoning, but I have a few theories, and that is the fact that postal workers were exempt. And that really kind of entertains me in a way. It gets me thinking, because it's like, okay, so you've got the official rule by Biden's administration was everybody who's working for the government should be required to get the vaccine, and anybody who works for a private corporation that has more than 100 employees should also be required to get the vaccine under penalty of losing their employment, right? That was the official Biden ruling. And then he's like, except for Congress and except for the postal workers. Now, why do you think that is? And I've spent some time thinking about this, and the only thing that I can think of is that it would lead to an absolute mess of our postal system. You simply wouldn't get packages delivered because you'd get so many people who were refusing. This is at a time when, you have to remember, everybody's hiring because people aren't willing to work, right? And so in an environment where all the different employers are struggling to get employees as it is, and even the Postal Service is having problems keeping their employees as it is, and then you say, okay, but you're now also required to get this vaccine, you can expect they're going to have trouble, you know, finding everybody that they need to do these jobs. And so it would be really difficult to save face from the Biden administration's standpoint if indeed the Postal Service did kind of fall apart as a result of the edict that he put into place. I'm not going to call it a law because it's not, but it is an edict put into place by the Biden administration. So he'd actually have to save face. And what's more important to him, and to them, I guess we'll say, because it's not really a him, is it? What's more important to them than supposedly health and safety, which, remember, is the veneer with which they force this upon people, is looking good themselves. Because if they really believed that this was necessary for health and safety reasons, then there is no justification for providing an exemption to the postal workers. None. They work together in confined places. There's more than 100 employees if you consider them to be a private company. If you don't consider them to be a private company, then everyone ought to get vaccinated. And yet here we are with an exemption for them. All that makes sense is, to the Biden administration, suddenly, it's actually not really about health. It's about something else. And you can think about what that is. My going theory is they don't want to look bad by the entire system falling apart and everybody complaining about the fact they can no longer even get, you know, the mail delivered on time. They can't even get their bills and their letters anymore. That's where we're really going, and that's what they're actually afraid of. West, by God bless, is postal workers only because they have the unions. The rest of the government doesn't have unions. Well, I mean, if you look at something like the educational system, they certainly have some of the biggest unions in the United States. If you look at the automotive industry, they certainly have very strong, big unions. And yet, no, if you look over in the area of steel, welding, that kind of thing up there in the Rust Belt, you still have pretty strong unions up there too. In all of those, there are no exceptions for these vaccines, at least not yet. I mean, I grant you the fact that the unions have power. However, I don't think that the postal union necessarily has significantly more power than, say, the biggest teachers union in the United States. I think there's more to it than that. I think it's about the Biden administration and whether or not they can basically look good. Hold on a sec. Okay, some of you guys are having problems with me freezing up. Sorry about that. Apparently, there's nothing that I can do about it, it would seem. All right. And yes, the illegal immigrants coming into the country, legal immigrants coming into the country don't have to get the vaccine, but everybody else does, which is what Jen Psaki, the press secretary, recently acknowledged quite literally in response to the question was, okay, so you mean that American workers have to get the shot, but the new people coming into the United States don't have to get the shot? And she's like, yes, that makes sense. And so when we say, I'm referring to the right here, say that the Americans are being made into a second class, it's like, well, how else do you say it? I mean, it's not language that I usually use. I don't even talk about immigration that much, frankly. However, it's impossible to see it anywhere else. It's impossible to see it as anything other than Americans are being made into a second class stream and a second class citizen, you might say, to new arrivals, and that's wrong. It should never be that way. Whether or not you're for continued immigration or not, you have to say that immigration should be for the benefit of America and Americans, and not necessarily for the benefit of those who are coming here. Yes, it benefits the new immigrant to arrive in the most prosperous country on earth, naturally, but their admittance here ought to be to, you know, also help America itself. That previously was the whole point of immigration. It's why you accepted immigrants, because they were going to help to, you know, make a better country by, you know, creating jobs and so on, and in some cases just creating workers when we didn't have enough. But in any case, the point was to help America, and also the worker as kind of an added benefit. But now it's like, in fact, they're given preferential status versus the Americans who have lived here multi-generationally, if you care about the economics, who have paid into the system multi-generationally. Tom League said they need to take the jobs from the unvaccinated. I have heard, actually, on some social media sites like Gab and so on, about the people who are saying that, you know, we're at 100 employees, we should go ahead and fire the vaccinated so that they can get hired somewhere else and just kind of just hold on to the unvaccinated. And I do think that would be really amusing, actually. I do like that. I do like that. Okay, I'm probably going to end the stream pretty soon. I'm just going to giving you guys a few minutes in order to ask any other questions you have, anything you want to talk about in particular. But I knew that we are way after the hour, so, and my voice is giving out again. I know you don't realize this, because I've been talking for like an hour and 15 minutes. And if you had an hour and a 15 minute conversation with somebody, most likely your throat wouldn't start sounding really hoarse, or your voice wouldn't sound really hoarse. But the thing is, in a conversation, you're only talking half the time. In this particular case, I've been talking the entire time. And so by the end of this show, there's little left of my voice. It sounds kind of hoarse. So sorry about that. Take a Walk says, we don't need immigrants, boomers just use them as cheap labor. Well, it is absolutely true that both sides of the political spectrum use immigrants and do so at the expense of the American worker. It's absolutely true. You have the Democrats who want to use them as voters, and then you have On the other side, the Republicans who want to use them as like a slave class to help the farmers and so on. That's absolutely true. And they ought to just be hiring Americans. And yes, that would result in things costing more if you hired Americans for those jobs. That's actually how it's supposed to work. It's actually how our economy is supposed to progress in a positive direction. Hiring slaves isn't the way to go. And I don't see an argument. I don't see a point in us arguing over the morality of bringing in immigrants to vote, because I think we all agree that that's wrong. But when you look at the kind of Republican arguments, which is the one of, well, we need them because they're cheap labor, and we need more cheap labor, that's more worth addressing, because there are lots of people who are like, well, what would we do? You know, what would we do if we didn't have people to work on the farms? It's like, well, okay, you do have people to work on the farms, you just have to pay them more. And yes, that results in things costing more. That's also how the economy actually progresses in a positive direction. You have the same people who are like, well, we don't know what to do about the fact that wages are stagnating. It's like, okay, well, look around at the decisions that are being made. The solution isn't bringing people in who are willing to work for a wage that an American wouldn't be willing to work for. And also to pay him in a way, like, you could pay an illegal more than you could pay an American in our current situation. And that's a real problem. Because, for example, if you you could hire a illegal immigrant for $15 an hour, and all you have to pay the illegal immigrant is $15 an hour, because that's it, it's cash, right? But if you hire an American and you wanted him to have $15 an hour and take home wages, you couldn't just pay $15 an hour total. You'd also have to pay the unemployment, you'd have to pay the Medicare and the Social Security and the payroll taxes and all of that. And so you end up paying significantly more to hire the American worker. And it's for that reason that you have industries down there who want to bring in more illegal immigrants so they can just, you know, well, here's your $15 an hour. We don't have to deal with any of this other stuff. It really is a real problem. And the poorest Americans who would normally work in those jobs are the people who... I'm trying to think of a polite expression for it, but who get the rough end of the stick and who ought to be employed in those situations in order to kind of climb their way out of poverty instead of being replaced by a slave class. And there is no moral argument for hiring that illegal alien than there would be for hiring a slave. I mean, the very same arguments. I mean, well, it's cheap labor, and therefore, well, how can you not? It's like seriously? Okay, anyway. Tobacco Row says, do you ice skate? I did once, and then I broke my kneecap. So, not since, but I was like 13 years old, and ended up, I was doing the thing where you kind of go around the ice skating rink, holding on with a hand. I was doing that, and then some school came in, and they wanted to use the ice skating rink for half of the area. And so they put these cones halfway down the ice, right? And so then you had to kind of go, you start going around halfway, holding on to the edge, at least I did, because, you know, cowardly. Yes. And then for that there's this run area where the cones are, where you have to kind of go without holding on to anything. So I got to that point, and I could either turn around, but there were people behind me doing exactly the same thing that I was doing. So I felt compelled to go forward next to the cones. And then I did, and I got all the way to the very end of this coned, icy area, and then I slipped and fell, and then my kneecap hit this, like, metal part at the very bottom of the area that you would hold on to, and yeah, that hurt, so no more ice skating since then. I've had no desire, so I only went then because I think friends wanted me to go, but in any case, haven't done it since. Moving down... All right, I'm just, I think we should probably wrap it up here. I don't think Brits are known for ice skating, are they? I don't know, what are Brits known for? Music, they've made some good music, but I can't think ice skating exactly. But I can't think of a sport. I mean, you can call cricket a sport, but I don't. I've never played. Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap this up, because this is kind of I don't think we're really going to get anywhere. All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, though. It's been fun. It really has. And so I'll go ahead and end it before it gets really strange. All right. I appreciate your company tonight. It's been fun. Thank you so much.